Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Haitians giving up their city.
It's so huge that you need to have all organization involved, and it's quite a challenge to coordinate that correctly.
The lack of coordination in Port-au-Prince between international agencies has created two tragic migrations, a crowded bottleneck getting relief into Haiti, and a slow exodus from the city by Haitians giving up. Giving up and getting out on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning, everyone. It's Tuesday, January 19th, and The Takeaway is, if you've decided to leave Port-au-Prince, what is your destination? Where do you go in devastated Haiti? I'm in Washington, D.C. this morning, and I'm joined in New York by Miles O'Brien, who's in this week for Celeste Headlee. Good morning, Miles.
Good morning, John. Let's get right to the top stories we're following this morning. As we've been telling you, it was 1 week ago today, the earth shook in Haiti, devastating the country. The staggering scope of the aftermath is now in sharper focus, with authorities estimating 200,000 dead, another 1.5 million homeless. That makes the catastrophe about as deadly as the 2004 Indian Ocean tsunami.
And joining us now is Jillian Dunn from the International Rescue Agency, who's in Port-au-Prince on the ground. Jillian, first of all, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you fine.
And Jillian, you're with the International Rescue Committee. How much of an exodus are you seeing, and where do you think people are going?
Yes, we are starting to see thousands of people starting to leave the city. As much as they would like to stay in their homes and near their communities and means of livelihoods, they're just finding it too difficult to do so. It's mostly people who have family in the surrounding communities, and those are the ones who have the option to go and stay with family until they can rebuild their homes.
And that's got to be a fraction of the huge number of people who are expected to be affected by this. It's certainly already in the millions. Jillian Dunn of the International Rescue Committee, stay with us from Port-au-Prince. We'll be back to talk to you in just a moment. Miles?
With 90% of those living in Port-au-Prince sleeping on the streets, the desperation of survivors is growing with each passing day. That's the sound of Haitian police chasing away scavengers. Defense Secretary Robert Gates says aid efforts have to be sped up.
As I said the other day, the worry is till we can get ample supplies of food and water to people, there is a worry that in their desperation, some will turn to violence.
Right now, there are 1,700 U.S. troops on the ground in Haiti, with another 5,000 expected in the country this week. The Haitian police usually numbers around 4,000, but that's dropped to 1,500 since the earthquake. United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon wants more blue-helmeted troops on the ground.
I recommend it that the Security Council raise the number of UN police officers in the mission by 1,500.
Speaking in Port-au-Prince yesterday, former President Bill Clinton says if you want to help,
send us money. Send money. Because we can turn it into where it's needed and distribute it. Otherwise, if you just send goods, it's just going to be clogged up, clogged up, clogged up.
And there's plenty of clogging taking place there in Port-au-Prince at this hour. The big story we're following here at home is today's special Senate election in Massachusetts. Democrat Martha Coakley is running neck and neck with Republican Scott Brown for Ted Kennedy's old seat. The health care bill may hang in the balance because Democrats need that seat to avoid a filibuster in the Senate. We'll have a detailed look at that race. In business news, Japan Airlines, the biggest airline in Asia, has filed for bankruptcy this morning. Asian markets were mixed on the news. European indices down. Wall Street futures are mixed. And the Dow gets underway at 10,609. The S&P opens at 1,136, and the NASDAQ opens at 2,287. Let's talk a little bit about the language we've used this morning. We've talked about scavengers, desperation, and violence. An earthquake is violence, but when you talk about people's response to something like a disastrous earthquake, what sorts of language do you use? We want to hear your response to what's the appropriate use of terms like looting and scavenger. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or leave a comment on our website, thetakeaway.org. The language of survival on The Takeaway.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning, everyone, from Washington, D.C. this morning and tomorrow. And good morning, Miles O'Brien, up there in New York, in for Celeste Headlee.
Good morning, John. How's it going down there?
Well, it's great, and we're going to be here for the next couple of days. And, you know, it's worth noting, it's more than worth noting, tomorrow will be 1 year since the Obama era began in America, in the world, and certainly here in this tough political town where politics is sausage and special interests and spinning wheels of power and backroom deals. It's all the stuff of Bob Woodward tell-alls and perhaps the less-than-all-telling political memoirs that come out of this city. This is just 1 year into this moment of change, the Obama era. A year ago, you may recall, the streets were packed with people conversing on the mall to see a moment, to hear a speech, to download on the bitter cold streets of the nation's capital that day some hope.
Our founding fathers, faced with perils that we can scarcely imagine, drafted a charter to assure the rule of law and the rights of man, a charter expanded by the blood of generations. Those ideals still light the world, and we will not give them up for expedience's sake.
Towering rhetoric a year ago, a parade of jumbotrons, you remember, lined up like huge playing cards at the center of power, and Obama the dealer. The rhetoric sounded so pretty, but the sausage-making of real politics since. Tasty, perhaps, but not pretty. A year later, no one is on the streets down here in Washington except to jog in the spring-like air. It hit 60 degrees yesterday afternoon, Miles. There were the usual tourists looking for the Space Museum, you know them. Mm-hmm. There was the White House, people looking for the White House, standing in line for the tour, the veterans memorials, lobbyists and lawmakers hurrying to and from cars, and in an irony that speaks volumes about America and about democracy and this media era, suddenly the whole Obama era may come down to a question of potholes, negative ads, and how angry some folks in Massachusetts are this morning. Then, talking to the world, today the Obama message goes out to the few in Massachusetts voting in that special election, vote number 60 in the Senate.
Think long and hard about getting in that truck with Martha's opponent. It might not take you where you want to go. And where we don't want to go right now is backwards to the same policies that got us into this mess in the first place when we just started to make progress cleaning it up.
What a difference a year makes in the rhetoric, certainly in the headlines. The campaign never referred to Massachusetts as a battleground state, and there was no mention of Haiti as the focus of the international community 1 year ago. Exploring the contrasts and changes in this short Obama year is why The Takeaway is spending today and tomorrow down here in Washington, D.C. But let's go to Haiti, which is the focus of both the international community, the Obama administration, and the relief effort, and certainly a lot of institutions here in Washington are mobilized on the Haitian relief effort. But joining us once again, Jillian Dunn, Director of Emergency Response from the International Rescue Committee. She's in Port-au-Prince, Haiti. And Carol Stern is CEO and President of the U.S. Fund for UNICEF. Carol Stern, let's begin with you. We talked about the exodus out of Port-au-Prince, which suggests that people are giving up on the city. What can you tell us about the state of coordination or the lack of it in the relief effort right now?
You know, I think the relief effort is as coordinated as it can possibly be, given the sense of a double disaster, what existed before and what's, you know, come afterwards. I know for UNICEF, we've had three planes get in. We yesterday doubled the number of spots we were distributing water. It may feel slow. It is slow. We wish it were quicker, but it is more than likely as fast as it possibly could have been.
Are there circumstances unique to Haiti? I'm reminded of the earthquake in China, where the Chinese infrastructure mobilized to an extraordinary degree, and the death toll there was about 100,000.
Well, you know, you start with the fact that Haiti was the poorest nation in the Western Hemisphere. It's been ravaged by numerous storms in the past, you know, in recent years. Before the storm, you had two doctors per 10,000 people in country, 50% of the population under the age of 18, only 54% with access to water before the earthquake hit. So you don't even have, you know, the basic infrastructure before the tragedy, and now you're faced with a place where the airport is shut down, the port gets shut down. You're behind
and that's
the
still a case,
everywhere you go.
A week a week after that earthquake struck. That is still the case. Carol Stern is CEO and president of the U.S. Fund for UNICEF. Jillian Dunn, director of emergency response for the International Rescue Committee. What do people say on the streets? If something could happen tomorrow, I want this. Or if they could just get this. What are people saying in their frustration, the ones that are staying in Port-au-Prince?
Well, their first concern, of course, is shelter. We have thousands of people who are sleeping in the open air. Towards dusk, as you go towards the city, you see thousands and thousands of people starting to lay cinder blocks across the roads and then lay sheets out onto the roads so that they can sleep there during the night. So shelter is the primary concern. The other concerns are what you would expect as far as food and water and sanitation and getting adequate health care.
And Jillian Dunn, we're talking this morning about the sensitivity of language and describing what people are doing to try to save themselves. Do you think there's an important distinction between reports of looting and a sense that people are merely trying to survive?
I think that there are always people who will take advantage of a situation like this and will start to loot and steal from their neighbors. But really, for the most part, people are very calm. They are frustrated, but they are calm. They know that we are there to help. There's no antagonism against IRC and other organizations here. But, of course, we do have concerns about the security of the population, especially those who are more vulnerable and those who are sleeping out on the streets. But overall, I would say that the situation is about what you expect from any population.
Indeed. Jillian Dunn is Director of Emergency Response for the International Rescue Committee. Thanks so much for joining us. And Carol Stern, would you agree with that assessment, that security, based on the reports you're hearing, is pretty good right now in Haiti, before we go?
Absolutely. That's what I'm hearing, exactly the same from our people on the ground, that it is calmer than people have a sense it is.
All right, to Carol Stern, CEO and president of the U.S. Fund for UNICEF, talking about the difficulties and also the positives in Haiti as people wait for relief, decide on whether they're going to stay in Port-au-Prince or leave, and the sensitivity of language in describing people trying to survive versus taking matters into their own hands and taking advantage of the situation, as Jillian Dunn said there. That's on The Takeaway.
The conversation going with your thoughts. Send them to us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
And at 15 minutes after the hour, let's take a look at some of the headlines we're following.
The U.S. Air Force has been dropping relief supplies to survivors of the earthquake in Haiti. Former President Bill Clinton told reporters on the ground he did not think help had been slow to arrive.
There are just more people who need the aid than have been able to get it. But I think we're getting there. I see it. It's much better now than it was 2 days ago. And day after tomorrow, it'll be better again.
Meanwhile, the UN Food Program is planning to tented camp for 100,000 homeless people on the outskirts of Port-au-Prince. The camp would be an instant city the size of Burbank, California.
Wow. Moving to other news. It's down to the wire in the state of Massachusetts. Today's special election to fill Ted Kennedy's Senate seat is expected to be a battle to the end. Democrat Martha Coakley and Republican Scott Brown are neck and neck. We'll get more from our Washington correspondent later in the show. The FBI may have violated the law when it collected thousands of U.S. telephone records during the Bush administration. Citing internal memos, The Washington Post reports that the FBI proclaimed non-existent terrorism emergencies to illegally gather those records. Overseas, the Chinese government says Google must obey the country's laws and traditions. That's being seen as an indication officials won't budge after the search giant threatened to pull out of the country if internet restrictions aren't relaxed. And finally, new analysis by the Pew Research Center suggests that an increase in wives who work has resulted in a shift over who gets the biggest economic boost from marriage. Let's look at some of the stories we're watching this morning. Miles?
Coming up, breaking up is hard to do. New York Times finance reporter Louise Story tells us who will get the house and who will get the triumph, the insult comedy dog if NBC and Conan O'Brien are to part ways. That's just in a few moments.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Hey, you want that to go?
Hey, our news takeouts. It's a full house here. I'm down in Washington with Todd Zwillick, Washington correspondent. Good morning, Todd.
Good morning, John. Welcome to Washington.
And up there with you, Miles, it's Ibrahim and Louise in the studio, right?
We miss you. We miss you.
All right. It's the whole takeout family. Let's begin with Todd Zwillick. The headline this morning out of Washington is the president may have, or has he, selected a date for the State of the Union speech.
Well, House leaders have confirmed, and the White House has confirmed, that January 27th, which is next week, John, will be the date of the State of the Union. It was a really strange state of affairs that we got this late in January without knowing exactly when the speech will be, and it's been a confusing state of affairs. They've been saying the whole time, the Democrats, we want to have health care done so the president can wrap it in a bow and thank Congress and present it to the public at the State of the Union.
Right.
But as we know, the health care bill wasn't done. If you want to have it done before the State of the Union, they simply didn't schedule the State of the Union. Now they've got it scheduled.
Deadlines have been slipping.
That's exactly right. And this has been a whole confusing state of affairs. And we've confirmed another thing from Congress, which is with all of the confusion in Massachusetts, will Democrats even have 60 votes in the Senate by the end of the day? All of these health care negotiations that have been going on are now in doubt. And Democrats have now been hatching a plan that's been confirmed to me that what they may have to do instead of negotiating a health care bill is simply have the House pass the Senate bill.
The Senate wouldn't have to re-vote, so there'd be no question of the 60 votes.
There'd be no question of the 60. However, the Senate bill has no public option, abortion language that the House can't stand, no tax on the rich, which the House insists on. Last week, I had a conversation with a liberal member from Massachusetts, Representative Peter Lynch from just outside Boston, about this very scenario. And listen to this prescient statement that Peter Lynch made.
If Massachusetts doesn't go the Democrats' way, one way to address that here is to have you all pass a Senate bill to avoid having to go to 60 again over there, because there wouldn't be 60.
They don't have the votes to pass the Senate bill in the House. They do not have the votes. I can guarantee that. Something has to change.
Something has to change. What's it going to be?
Nobody knows. This is truly a murky state of affairs. You see a liberal Democrat from Massachusetts reflecting just how difficult to spot the Democrats are. Now, one thing seems to be pretty clear. They're not going to have this done by the State of the Union. Primetime speech. The president can present an agenda. He's not going to be able to thank Congress for health care. He's going to have to say, we're on the precipice.
And how many Democratic senators will be in that,
exactly.
In that chamber? Todd Zwillick, Washington correspondent, thanks so much.
Sure.
Back to you, Miles, in the studio in New York.
Let's do some more takeout, shall we? Late night talk show host Conan O'Brien is leaving NBC. Have you heard about that a little bit?
Just a little.
Rumor has it he will tape his last show next Friday. And when he goes, he might also leave behind this popular skit.
It's premiere night here for Attack of the Clones, but outside the Ziegfeld Theater is the real show, Return of the Dorks.
Ah, yes. Triumph the Insult Dog, a recurring character on the show, Pimpbot 5000, Conando, and then there's that bear. We won't say what the bear does. 16 years worth of intellectual property. Louise Story is financial reporter for our partner, the New York Times. Louise, this is kind of shades of what happened when Letterman left for CBS. Could he take the top 10 list, all that kind of stuff. Let's talk, first of all, about what kind of intellectual property there is that Conan might be able to take away. I'm sure it's all part of the negotiation, right?
So Conan not only has these characters who you named, but also particular skits like the Year 3000 skit. He's been on there 16 years, so of course, all of the things he's known for are property of NBC, and this has been a
NBC owns it all?
That's typically how these things work, but you negotiate over it, and apparently this was a big part of their negotiations. You know, he's leaving with some $40 million.
But is it really have any value to anybody else?
Well, that's the funny thing. You know, it's hard to imagine these skits without Conan.
Right.
And, you know, sometimes when networks keep these characters, it's a little bit of kind of a, goodbye to you. We're not giving you your characters.
I mean, you know, it's
but
not
wouldn't
like
you
Leno's.
Love to see Brian Williams do Pimpbot 5000?
I'm not sure that would work. You know, when Letterman left NBC to go to CBS back in the early 90s, there was a similar fight. He lost the ability to take some of his skits with him, but he simply renamed them. So Viewer Mail became the CBS Mailbag, and the character Larry Bud Melman, that actor kept coming on, but he came on under his real name, Calvert DeForest. And, you know, the top 10 list got renamed the Late Show Top 10 List. So you might see something like that with Conan. There was a funny, I don't know if you remember, when Letterman first went on CBS, there was a funny skit where Tom Brokaw came on from NBC. And he came on and he went over and he grabbed the cue cards and said, oh, sorry, these are property of NBC. And then Letterman said, well, legally, I can continue to call myself Dave. So I'm sure there'll be humor around this.
He checked with his lawyers. All right, Louise Story, thank you very much. We'll be watching that development unfold because the saga continues. Late night TV.
Apparently NBC doesn't want to own Conan's hair, I guess. Our last takeout, Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, takeaway sports contributor. There is a new star in the NBA, and it's not in the East. It's in the West. Ibrahim, where should we look at the NBA right now?
Well, if you paid attention to any of the basketball on during the Martin Luther King Day, Oklahoma City, which formerly was the Seattle SuperSonics, was playing the Atlanta Hawks, and it's a battle of teams that are sort of lower top tier teams in the NBA. But the key player on the Oklahoma City is a guy named Kevin Durant. He's 21 years old. He was a 2007 Rookie of the Year. He averages 28 points per game. He's 6'9" with a 7'5" wingspan. He is the next star of the NBA.
Incredible. And where did Durant come from?
He was a star at Texas. He played there for 1 year, and now he jumped to the NBA. But let's not forget about college basketball right now, because Texas and Kentucky, up until last night, Texas was undefeated with Kentucky. And then last night, Kansas State beat Texas in a thriller where some of their top players were reduced to rubble underneath the Kansas State pressure. It was a really amazing game. But now you have Kentucky that will be the only undefeated team in college basketball. So the college basketball game is heating up right now.
Wow, well, there are two takeaways, Kentucky and Kevin Durant, who also entered the NBA straight out of college without graduating, right?
Correct. He was a freshman and then he went straight
Ibrahim
to the NBA.
Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, takeaway sports contributor. Those are your takeouts.
There we go.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, U.S. Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius will be with us to talk about her department's piece of the Haitian recovery efforts. That's in just a few minutes. But right now, let's check in on the top news stories at 30 minutes after the hour. It's been a week since the earthquake hit Haiti, one of the worst disasters in the history of the Western Hemisphere. The European Commission now estimates there are 200,000 dead and another 1.5 million homeless. Thousands of Haitians are fleeing the city of Port-au-Prince, heading to the countryside in search of food, water, and shelter. Those left behind are facing increased desperation. The sound there of Haitian police chasing away a crowd that was breaking into a store. Apart from anything needed for survival, toothpaste has become valuable because survivors are using it to line the inside of their nostrils to fight the stench of decay. The U.S. military, though, considers the security situation stable. Rear Admiral Mike Rogers, the Director of Intelligence for the Joint Chiefs of Staff, says the means of aid distribution and search and rescue missions are possible.
We have seen nothing that suggests to us that we have widespread disorder. No sense of widespread panic.
Right now, there are 1,700 U.S. troops on the ground in Haiti, with another 5,000 expected in the country this week.
The big story we're following here at home is today's special election in Massachusetts. Democrat Martha Coakley is running neck and neck with Republican Scott Brown for Ted Kennedy's old seat. The health care bill may hang in the balance because Democrats need that seat to avoid a filibuster in the Senate. Two big business stories this morning. Japan Airlines, the biggest airline in Asia, filed for bankruptcy this morning. It's one of the biggest corporate failures in Japanese history. The airline will cut 16,000 jobs as part of its restructuring. And Cadbury, the British candy maker, has accepted Kraft's improved offer worth nearly $19 billion, potentially ending a months-long corporate battle to create the world's largest maker of chocolate and sweets. A sweet deal indeed. Let's check the markets. Asian markets were mixed. European indices are down. Wall Street futures are mixed. The Dow gets underway at 10,609. S&P opens at 1,136. The NASDAQ opens at 2,287. Those are some of the news stories we're watching this morning.
We go live now to U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius. She has some of the responsibility for providing medical care and aiding relief efforts in Haiti, the details of which we spoke about there in the headlines. Good morning, Secretary Sebelius.
Good morning. How are you?
Great. One question right off the bat. Since HHS traditionally is responsible for the health of Americans, I was surprised to learn that you had a large and significant role in the Haitian relief effort.
Well, the way the sort of government relief effort is structured even internationally is that HHS has one of the leads in the public health response, and also our Centers for Disease Control personnel are on the ground helping to secure and look at the safe water and food supply. So we kind of have a dual role, along with lots of partners. John, this is an incredible international effort with under UN umbrella, lots of countries and about 30 nations and hundreds of NGOs who are involved. So the U.S. is part of that very massive operation.
Are you hearing from your teams on the ground some of the reports that we're hearing of difficulty coordinating, of a need for some central authority, and the UN sort of reeling from the effects of the earthquake last week, and the Haitian government maybe not being as tough or as strong as it needs to be?
Well, I think there's no question this is an enormously difficult environment. The logistics are difficult. A lot of the infrastructure was destroyed, and some of the infrastructure wasn't terribly robust to begin with. So just landing planes and unloading them has been, I think, a significant challenge. Getting enough housing for the people who want to help, food and water has been pouring into the country and more every day, but getting that distributed. So each of those kind of challenges along the way, I think the good news is things are getting better. There's a definitely a coordinated effort. The UN has had their biggest loss of life in UN history with the direct hit on their headquarters. So there are lots of folks who are really struggling in this environment.
You know, we are hearing conflicting reports on whether the U.S. is allowing seriously injured Haitians to be transferred to, say, Miami and other cities on the Gulf for surgery and treatment. What can you say about U.S. policy if there is one? And shouldn't the U.S. medical infrastructure, robust as it is, be offered to the Haitians here?
I'm not sure I can speak very effectively to the transfer. I think the goal has been, John, to get the people on the ground to actually treat folks. As you know, moving people is not necessarily the best idea. So not only are there, we have now 265 medical personnel on the ground, including surgical teams and medical teams. There are hospital facilities being set up in five different areas. There's a hospital ship that is about to be operational with many more additional facilities. So I think the focus has been how we get personnel as quickly into country and operational as fast as possible. Over 1,000 patients have been seen in the last 2 days, and that's a real step forward and very good news.
Indeed. If I'm a family in Port-au-Prince and making the difficult decision to either give up on the city and maybe go out in the countryside and fend for myself or stay and wait it out, what would your message to me and other families like me be?
Well, I would think that the efforts to get and food, water, shelter are, as I say, more robust every day. And so the opportunity to be taken care of in a more direct fashion is probably better if they actually stay put. I don't know what the facilities are like the further out country you get. And certainly there's a challenge with logistics. I know folks traveling from the Dominican Republic, the other side of the island, have had some serious challenges because the earthquake ramifications reached out into the countryside. But there's been a swift response. There's a coordinated civilian-led effort in this very difficult environment. And distributing relief, as well as, John, one of the other functions that we're very much involved in is the American citizens, almost 45,000 American citizens who actually
sure.
live in Haiti. Over 3,000 are now back in the United States, and more are arriving every day.
Well, I'm hearing there a guarded, sit-tight message from Kathleen Sebelius, U.S. Secretary of Health and Human Services. Before we go, this special election up in Massachusetts may hold the fate of the entire health care reform bill, which, if it does get passed, would pass to your responsibility to actually implement. Does it surprise you that this whole political battle may come down to the question of how many potholes were filled in some neighborhoods in Boston?
Well, I think around every turn there's an interesting challenge, but I'm very confident that Martha Coakley will be the next senator. On a personal basis, it's time they sent a woman to the Senate. I'm pleased with that opportunity. And, you know, we've been working hard on reconciling the House and Senate bills. About 90% of the bills are in agreement. And I'm very hopeful that having this much work over the last year been done on behalf of the American people, we will actually be able to get a bill to the president's desk in the next couple of weeks.
All right, Kathleen Sebelius, thanks so much for being a part of the program. U.S. Secretary for Health and Human Services watching Haiti and that special election in Massachusetts. She spoke with us here in Washington. All day we are asking, listen to Kanye West.
I hate the way they portray us in the media. If you see a black family, it says they're looting. See a white family, it says they're looking for food.
Thinking about Haiti, what is appropriate language of survival after a disaster? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or comment on the website takeaway.org. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry in Washington.
And I'm Miles O'Brien in New York, in for Celeste Headlee on vacation this week. The BBC's interactive program, World Have Your Say, has been speaking to ordinary people in Haiti about the disastrous earthquake that took place 1 week ago. Here's an example of some of the responses the BBC has been hearing from Haiti.
We don't have no houses. Most of the houses destroyed. Even the houses stand up, people scared to sleep on them. Most of these people don't eat since Tuesday night. Thursday, 2 days after, they bring some cookies. Last night, they threw food in the street. We can't even get them.
A lot of emotion there. World Have Your Say host Roz Atkins has just returned to London after a trip to Florida, where he hosted three shows among the Haitian-American community. Roz, good to have you with us. Who have you been speaking to? What have you been hearing?
Hi, Miles. Thanks for having me on The Takeaway. Well, we spent 3 days, two in Southwest Florida and the third on Friday in Little Haiti in Miami. And essentially what we were trying to do was connect Haitians living in the States with Haitians back home, or at least people in Port-au-Prince who could give them information. What unfolded was incredibly difficult for all our listeners to listen to, I think, and of course much more difficult still for the people taking part, because in those first couple of days after the earthquake took place, people just couldn't make any connection. We were having these audience shows, and on the front row would be 15, 20 Haitians, all holding their mobile phones, their cell phones, texting, going through Facebook, trying to call during the program and having no luck at all. So we were able to, mainly using Skype to be honest, able to connect them with one woman called Dixie, who ran an orphanage in Port-au-Prince, another guy called Rene, who was a radio reporter, who we were able to speak to over Skype. And of course, it was a terrible thing because these Haitians in Southwest Florida and in Little Haiti wanted information. But when they got the information from Port-au-Prince, you know, much more often than not, it wasn't what they wanted to hear.
So looking for information is the obvious thing. Is my loved one, is my friend okay? Beyond that, what are the people saying in the Haitian American community?
Well, the second issue, and you're right, first and foremost, of course, people were concerned with getting hold of their loved ones. But the second issue, and this was coming out when we broadcast at 1 p.m. Eastern on the Wednesday, so this is less than 24 hours after the earthquake, they were already talking about the media. They were already angry. And in the item I was listening to just before I came on, you played that clip by Kanye West talking about the phrase looting. That's the word a lot of people have already latched onto. They feel that the developed world's media or the Western media is jumping far too quickly to suggest that all law and order is breaking down. In fact, I just before I came to see you picked up an email from a World Have Your Say regular in Australia called Andrew saying, look how quickly society breaks down when cities are destroyed. But lots of Haitians are pushing back and saying, well, it's not really breaking down. Of course, we're going into shops when we need food or we need medicine, but that's not breaking down. That's just survival, to use Kanye West's words. So there is a frustration that from the off, people have been prepared to think the worst of Haiti and of Haitians when they're reacting to this terrible tragedy.
All right, Roz, thank you very much. Roz Atkins is the host of World Have You Say. Thank you very much. Appreciate that. And that takeaway question this morning is, what do you think about how the media is covering this? And is the media covering this in a way with some sort of racial tone to it? What's the difference between looting and survival?
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. I'm Miles O'Brien in for Celeste Headlee on vacation. I'm in New York. John Hockenberry in D.C. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Miles.
Coming up, as more and more Americans are changing careers in the face of record unemployment, we'll discuss some of the skills that every successful worker in America has, regardless of whether they wait tables or perform heart surgery. That story is coming up in just a few moments. Right now,
that's intriguing. Yes, is that Koblenzer?
Yes, Koblenzer is here.
She's got
some ideas here, and I'm getting ready to try out my hammer and nail, whatever it takes. Right now, let's check the leading stories at 47 minutes after the hour. Since the earthquake struck Haiti 1 week ago today, U.S. donations for the country have passed $200 million, and the flow of planes into the airport has improved dramatically. Former President Bill Clinton says things are getting better every day.
The aid is pouring in here. We've gone from 3 planes a day landing at the Port-au-Prince Airport to 67 planes a day.
Meanwhile, Defense Secretary Robert Gates says he does not foresee an expanded security role for the U.S. military in the country.
We still see the UN and MINUSTA in the lead here. We are there in support of them and the government of Haiti.
And President Obama's handling of the U.S. response to the earthquake has received widespread approval. As he completes his first year in office, his job approval has risen to 50%, according to a new CBS News poll. It's unclear how much the Haiti effort has impacted that figure, however. John.
Former Chinese Supreme Court judge was sentenced to life in prison for corruption today. He was accused of taking bribes equivalent to more than $500,000 in exchange for favorable rulings in Beijing. Back at home, Jay Leno took a few moments to be serious about the late night chaos at NBC.
So they come and they go, listen, this show isn't working. We want to let you go. Can I get out of my contract? They go, no, you're still a valuable asset to the company. How valuable can I be? You fired me twice. How valuable can I be?
Serious, right. Leno says his NBC plans that NBC plans to put him back in that 11:35 slot. Today, big business news internationally. JAL, the biggest airline in Asia, files for bankruptcy. And on the other side of the world, the food giant Kraft has agreed to pay about $19 billion in cash and stock for British chocolate maker Cadbury, a deal ending nearly 200 years of independence for Britain's largest candy company, and a longstanding drama between the two companies as to whether it was even going to be acquired or not. For our international business segment today, BBC business correspondent Mark Gregory joins us from London with the latest. So, Mark, does this end the drama?
Well, it appears to, though it's still possible in theory that Hershey, the American company that, of course, you're very familiar with, will come up with a higher bid. But that seems pretty unlikely. So it's almost certain now that Kraft's going to get its prize. But it's been quite a fight. Essentially, Cadbury's management said to begin with that Kraft was not offering nearly enough money. They raised their offer by $2 billion and that shut the shareholders up. And they seemed like they're going to take the money.
What market does Kraft get into by acquiring Cadbury?
Well, Cadbury, of course, is famous as a British chocolate maker, but actually what Kraft is buying is Cadbury's access to fast-growing, developing country markets. Cadbury is really big in places like India and Mexico, and the betting among many multinational companies, including Kraft, is that increasingly they're going to have to go to developing country markets in future to get their markets, as they're mainly in their established markets. It's pretty mature, not much growth. So that's why Kraft has been interested in Cadbury. It sees it as a very, very good way into the developing world. And also remember, by joining forces with Cadbury, Kraft now becomes the world's largest chocolate and candy maker.
Does that mean we're all going to have to learn over here in the States what biscuit means to you guys?
Quite possibly, yes. And there's been a certain amount of sadness in this country about the loss of Cadbury. It is, if you like, what you might describe as a kind of iconic brand set up by Quakers in the 19th century, known for its business practice and its Quaker ethics and that kind of thing. But that was all a long time ago. The reality is, for quite a while now, Cadbury has been just another big global company.
And in the Kraft empire, a biscuit is now a cookie. BBC business correspondent Mark Gregory, thanks so much for that. And those are some of the headlines we're following this morning.
If you're out of work and looking for a job, you are learning about a changing economy and how you might fit into it or not. in a new way. And if you look long and hard enough at your own skill set, you may find you can do many more things than you first thought. UCLA professor Mike Rose has taken a look at this and is out with a book, The Mind at Work, which may help you recognize some talent and experience you might take for granted. For this week's work segment, we're talking with him as well as with our trusty work contributor, Beth Kobliner, who is also the author of a book. Hers is Get a Financial Life. Good to have you both with us. Good morning, Mike. Good morning, Beth.
Hi.
Hi there.
Mike, you got this idea, as I understand it, for the book, from your late mother, who happened to be a waitress, and her skills you felt were transferable to a career which you might not predict. Tell us about that.
Well, Miles, I grew up in a working-class family. You know, my uncles were machinists. My mother was a waitress. A lot of folks worked in factories, and I just always had the sense that these folks were smart people. And I undertook this project to try and demonstrate all the intelligence involved in the kinds of blue-collar work that we were just talking about. So my mother, for example, I mean, she was very adept at remembering things. She was really good at taking in a room at a glance and knowing what was going right and what wasn't going right. She was great at prioritizing things that would fly at her, right, and be able to move about a busy restaurant. She was really good at reading people. I mean, those are pretty impressive intellectual skills.
And you're multitasking if you're a waitress. There's a lot of things you have to do to make that work. I guess, Beth, let's bring you in on this. How do you turn that into something that is sort of saleable on a resume?
Right.
It's sometimes hard to explain this if you're applying for a job that's completely far afield.
Right. Well, first off, you know, as we said, unemployment right now is at 10%, but blue-collar workers have been especially hard hit, and we have to say that. You know, everybody knows about closing of factories, but if you look at specific jobs as of December, the highest unemployment rate is among construction workers, with a rate of more than 22%. But that group, and because of the economy, you want to be more nimble. And one example would be conventional thinking is blue-collar workers usually don't have resumes. You know, the last 20 years, that was not something they do. So more and more, there was an article in the Chicago Times about how they are starting to put together resumes and put things on resumes, such as did more customer interaction or developed. Mike has a great example in his book about his uncle developed a product as a paint sprayer, which then went on to save the company money. So really having targeted resumes that can help you get other jobs, perhaps in the same field or other fields.
The expression is you need to toot your own horn a little bit, and this is important, and it's also important, Dr. Rose, to know what to toot. And what would you suggest to viewers, sort of a takeaway for them, on how they would go through this self-examination and see these talents and skills?
Well, I think one thing you would do would be to sit down and really ask yourself the kinds of questions that you and Beth are raising right now. What really did I do on that job that I just had? You know, what were the kinds of things that I had to do every day and had to do well? What kinds of intellectual skills were involved in this? Even at first glance, if it doesn't seem like there was much there, there may be more there than you think. And then the question becomes, are these transferable to other kinds of work? Now, Miles, I want to make a point here. I don't want to be glib about this. I mean, obviously, we can't willy-nilly drop from one job to another. I'm a pretty good problem solver in the work I do, but put me in the middle of a pulmonary clinic, and I would be, you know, pretty incompetent.
We got the OR set up right here, Mike. We were just going to test
you out.
This
is very honest of you.
I'm on my way over, Beth. But the point I do want to make is that if you have developed skills in solving problems or in prioritizing a lot that's coming at you or at reading people, then that does give you an orientation and a body of experience in being competent in those kinds of skills. And as you learn a new area, as you build a knowledge base in a new kind of work, and if someone, maybe yourself or someone there at work, can point out to you the overlap between the kinds of things you used to be able to do and what you can do now, then I think that gives you a real advantage.
All right, and Beth, just quickly, what's easier? Which direction? Blue collar to white collar, white collar to blue collar?
I think it's tricky, but I liked what Mike talked to me about once, that, you know, a hair cutter. You think, oh, it's a hair cutter. But he said, people go into a hair cutter and say, you know what? I want a summery look. You know, I would be like, what the heck does that mean? But a good hair cutter knows what a summery look means, taking the abstract to concrete. And I think understanding you have that skill will take you a long way when you're putting that on your resume.
Beth Kobliner here, Mike Rose in Los Angeles. Thank you both.
Thank you.
That was great. Lots to think about there. Lots to think about. Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick is going to analyze that special Senate election underway in Massachusetts. The entire health care reform bill could be on the line. You can read it at thetakeaway.org. And also, leave a comment, won't you? Think of a picture or an image you've seen from Haiti. When is survival something called looting or thievery? When is taking advantage actually survival? We're talking about language of disaster. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Miles O'Brien. This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to The Takeaway podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
You come to The New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.